This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is cartoonist and social satirist Gayon Wilson, who became nationally known through his cartoons in Playboy, The New Yorker, and National Lampoon. Wilson's cartoons have earned the adjectives macabre and weird. In one cartoon, a monster is towering over a diner that is lit with a neon sign saying, "Eat." Inside the diner, one man, looking worried, says to another, "Do you suppose the monster can read?" In another cartoon, a chimney cleaner is standing over a skeleton which is dressed in a Santa Claus suit. The chimney cleaner says, "Well, we found out what's been clogging your chimney since last December." Monsters and corpses are common in Wilson's cartoons. He's a great fan of werewolf and vampire movies, and even made his own pilgrimage to Transylvania to visit the historic Castle Dracula. Wilson's latest book, Gayon Wilson's America, combines his cartoons with his written commentary on subjects ranging from the commercialization of religion to the hazards of urban life. I asked Gayon Wilson about his fascination with monsters. He told me he thinks monsters are great metaphors for human fears and weaknesses.
One lovely example for me is dear old Boris Karloff's variant on the Frankenstein monster, which was this pathetic, sad, heartbreaking, clumsy, awkward being, and is, I think, maybe one of the most magnificent analogs for adolescence that has ever been created. This awful, terrible, ghastly phase of growing up where we would want so much to be smooth and slick and absolutely flawless and Dave Niven, you know, and we are in reality full of pimples and we can't talk well and we are physically totally inept. We bump into things and so on. And we're the Frankenstein monster. We're this ridiculous, absurd thing. He's a friend, you know. And then things like a werewolf, of course, that's dead obvious. We all are werewolves, and we all have full moons, of numerous full moons. And we swear to God, like Lon Chaney Jr., when, you know, "Soon the moon will be full, and I will undergo another of my terrible experiences." And we know it's going to happen, you know, but we're not going to do it this time. We just know we're not going. We swore we won't do it, and we do it. You know, the hair starts growing all over our face, and there we are. Our clothes don't fit, and we're wolves again. And then the frightening thing, the handling just sheer fear. I mean, the Dracula is that is the spookiness of, you know, the really scary stuff. I mean, the funny whiff of something in the basement, you know, or the down the street behind that bush, there was, I think, something, you know, but no, there's nothing there, but still, you know, that's Dracula. And it's all, it's great stuff. And without it, we wouldn't be able to come to grips, I think, with ever so much.
When you watched monster movies, especially when you were a kid, did you identify with the monsters or with the victims?
I think that varies with the movie. I think it you don't tend to identify with the blob, but
what about with Frankenstein?
But with Frankenstein, werewolf? You definitely identify with the Frankenstein monster, certainly with the Karloff version. With Dracula, except in very dark moods, you don't tend to identify with Dracula. And then there's just the release of isn't it fun to be scared and I'm not really scared, which is the roller coaster idea. It's great to go woo like that. I heard a absolutely appalling tape once of a you know, awful fluke. They happened to record this thing. There was people on a roller coaster, and the damn thing went off the tracks, and this hideous accident occurred. And you got the scream of the people going woo like that on the thing, and all of a sudden it went off, and they turned into ah. You know, it was just horrible. And it's not the same sound. It is not the same sound. So when you hear the people in the audience screaming at, you know, the jellied Dewacky from outer space. They are not making the same noise that they make if somebody is actually coming at them with a cleaver.
In 1978, I think it was, you went to Castle Dracula in,
yes,
in Transylvania.
Yeah.
Did you try to take the same route in a coach as they do in the movie and
yeah,
the novel?
Yeah, what I did was I was in the area and I thought, why not? So I called Playboy and asked if they'd be interested if I did an article for them on Dracula Country, and they said, sure, go ahead. And so I contacted the Romanians, and I was guest of the government for quite a stretch of time, and they put me in this black Mercedes, and they drove me around the joint with the guide who was an expert on Dracula, on the vampire phenomenon, all the rest of it. When I was a kid, I thought that Transylvania was made up, like Oz or...
yeah, I did too.
Yeah, I thought just a place that somewhere where Dracula could operate, and Stoker just thought it up. And I found out it was true. It really was a Transylvania, and I was determined to go there. And but then when I actually found that I was going to really do it, I thought, oh gosh, it's going to be just like Evanston, and what a letdown this is going to be. And it wasn't. It was spectacularly like it's supposed to be.
When you were in Transylvania, and especially when you were in the Castle Dracula, were you overcome by any irrational fears, even though you were quite confident that there were no vampires?
No, I found that... I found the poetic thing was quite quite much there. I found, for example, there's the historical Dracula is buried in a place called Snagov. There's a little island, a small island, which is his church, and he was buried there. And when I was there, it was a lovely, sunny, Cerati sort of day, and we rowed out to this island with ducks in the water and... it was all very sweet and nice, and there was this place where he was, and I thought, how touching. It was an odd thing. And then I was actually almost killed in the Carpathians in this glorious experience where the Carpathians are very, very rugged, and we were going higher and higher and higher. And when we started, that was a nice day, and the higher we got, more overcast it came, and I looked up, and the clouds were sort of swirling in a circular fashion, closing towards the center. And as we almost got to this, we were going over the highest thing, the Fagarish Pass, and they've hewed a tunnel through. And this road was unbelievably bad because, as my guide said, they are very mystical there, and they have a kind of odd ecological thing, and... He said, we do not like to force a road on the mountain. We suggest it. We merely bulldoze it open. We only hint at it. And if the mountain accepts it, we put the concrete. If the mountain rejects it, we build somewhere else. And the mountain had rejected practically all of this this road. And just as we were about to go through the tunnel, I heard this sort of whoop, whoop, whoop sound, and I looked around, and there was this lightning bolt coming at us from the rear, and it whacked to the top of this tunnel, and rock bits came whack-de-whack on top of this Mercedes. And then we went in the tunnel, and, oh, there was a lady in just within the tunnel holding a lantern under her face so she was lit from beneath like they do in the horror movies, and she was making sort of gesture in front of her to ward us off, I guess. And we came out in this most god-awful storm, unbelievable thing, and you couldn't see, the window was just obscured, and lightning flashes, and you would, in the flashes, you would see twisty trees and rocks and so on, just like in a classic horror movie. Incredible. And I just loved it. It was absolutely fantastic. And then all of a sudden, the road went, and we started going down. We were in an avalanche, part of an avalanche. And this driver, who was a brilliant sort of Ian Fleming-type style guy, kept going zoom, zoom, zoom like that, and he somehow or other kept a kind of traction on this slip down, and I haven't any idea how he managed to do it. He got on a hold of something, which got a hold of something else, and finally got back so we were actually on the road again. And
then very much on cue again, very theatrically again, it cleared, and we got down. There's this little inn, and we staggered out to this this quaint thatched place to get ourselves a belt. And there's this huge, big pale butterfly, sort of flopped out of the bushes and sort of slowly went in front of us, lazily waving its wings. And this guy was showing me the country. He said,
I see Dracula has come to welcome us in the form of a gigantic white butterfly.
My guest is cartoonist and satirist Gayon Wilson. His latest book is titled Gayon Wilson's America. Another theme that recurs in your work, and there's a wonderful chapter on it in your new book, is childhood fears, and especially some of the really irrational ones that we all have. I'd like to go over some of those with you and see if you had them and where you think they came from. The toilet monster is really one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Could you explain the toilet monster?
The toilet monster is if in the middle of the night, you have to go to the bathroom. You have to be very careful because there is this thing who lives down in the works underneath there. All plumbing is a source of great peril and danger because it goes from the known world into the unknown depths there, and that's why we have all these things about snakes coming into the bathtub via the drain, and we know, of course, about the crocodiles and the sewers and all that sort of stuff. But there's also this thing which is somehow associated with the toilet. It's down there, and at night, if you flush the toilet, you're liable to waken it, and it may come up and get you. So you have to flush it and get the hell out very quickly.
Were you really worried about that?
I thank God I wasn't. This was something that I heard from somebody else, but a lot of the other ones.
Making a face. What's going to happen if you make a face?
Making a face. If you make a face and somebody startles you, like you get slapped in the back, or there's an explosion or backfire, something like that. You've got to watch out because it might freeze on your face forever. So you'll have for the rest of your life. And then a lot of stuff happens is because parents don't understand and make you do things that are obvious, they're fatal. I mean, like eating cherries with milk. Every kid knows eating cherries with milk or something else. It depends on the region and so on. There are various combinations of food which are fatal. And parents don't understand that. And they make the kid do it anyhow. And the kid does it because he's a good kid, and it kills him. And the parents feel very bad because they've done it. But that's life. That's the way it goes. That's part of growing up. And there's also stuff like trying to cope with the mysterious areas. Like if something falls down into a drain or something, like a ball or a dime rolls down, don't reach into the thing with your bare hands because something may get it, you know, your fingers or the whole hand and pull you in or something like that.
What about water fountain germs?
Water fountain germs are typically, contagion is a big kid thing. And, of course, a water fountain is a mass of horrible contagious possibilities. And the thing is that if you rub the fountain top part carefully, what will happen is germs just go around underneath a little edge there and wait, and then when you turn the water, they'll all pop out and get you. And it goes on like that. There's no safety if you're a kid anywhere at all.
You're really such an expert on childhood fears, and so many people read your childhood fears type cartoons and say, yeah, how did he know about that? I did that. Did you do any real research on it? Does this come mostly from your past? Do people start confiding in you now what things used to really trouble
them?
Well,
it started with my past, and it started with just watching, I just watch kids. Most people don't watch kids. People just don't. They sing, isn't that cute? And it's not cute, you know. It's this little kid, which is this suffering little so-and-so. I mean, they, like, you see this, you know, a little kid and he's trying to walk, and he's walking along and across the living room floor, and he lifts his leg and boom, it goes down, and then he goes, and then he falls. You know, this great crash, and it's terrific. You know, oof, the air's knocked out of him, and I say, ah, you know, like that. And it's like nothing happened. You know, he's just been through a real tough experience. There they are. We sentimentalize a little things, and because they're little things, but they to them, you know, they're full size. I mean, that's all there is. Just as this kid.
You have a chapter in your book Gay and Wilson's America devoted to smile buttons. You think that smile buttons exemplify the whole idea of phony fun?
Yeah, they irritate me very much. I suppose one reason is because, as a humorist, I am I'm particularly aware of the value of what a smile represents. I mean, this is a smile is an extraordinary achievement, and humanity has done it. I mean, there's animals have got a sense of fun, and they like to frisk, and they've got a rudimentary idea of absurdity and silliness and all that, but a real smile is a human thing. I mean, this is a remarkable damn thing, and it's very brave, and it's very insightful, and it's very profound. And to say make these little fake slap-on sticker smiles is cheapens them and doesn't understand them and makes very light of them. And also, the other aspect is they've been grabbed onto by the worst possible, jerkiest people. And so you'll find yourself on, you know, atrocious airlines and with this crummy plane, which the inflammable seats, and the stewardess will give you insulting service. And then she'll slap this disgusting plate of garbage on your little thing, which is supposed to be lunch. And then you'll look and you'll see on the little napkin is this smile. I mean, that's the final touch. I'll take all the rest of it. I mean, I can stand the rest of it, but the smile, that's too much. I draw the line at that smile.
It seems to also go along with the idea of people forcing themselves to have a good time no matter what.
No matter what. By God, we're going to have a... Yeah, it starts with... I mean, everybody is gone through the hell of getting back to the kid thing of not having a good time when you're supposed to have a good time. And there's all howling children at every vacation paradise. You always just look at the view, You know, it's just terrible. And we all know, eat that food. That's good food. You enjoy the... it's terrible. It's terrible. So this sort of desperate thing of this is great. This is great. You know, and if you just say, hey, maybe it's it's a little of this, it's a little of that. You know, everything. I think we'd all be a lot happier, really.
I want to talk a little bit about your background. Did you read a lot of comics and watch a lot of cartoons when you were growing up?
Yeah, absolutely.
What did you think were the best and the worst of the cartoons and the comics from your childhood?
Well, I adored the villains in Dick Tracy, as drawn by Chester Gould, because they were marvelously grotesque, and I was fascinated and remain fascinated by how he would draw these... unbelievably weird faces in this sort of crude, primitive style. And you'd think, well, you can't do anything with that face. I mean, that's just this sort of scritchy, scratchy, weird-looking thing. But he would be able to get every play of expression in that. That absolutely fascinated me. It was a very educational and inspiring thing to me. And then I loved the comic books, all of them. They were swell. Captain Marvel was my particular favorite for super people. I like Plastic Man. He was fun. He also struck me as being a good sort of weird hero. And I loved the EC comics, of course, which were just models of depravity. And I liked Goya. Goya's it was I got onto him fairly early, and it was fascinating. He's been very influential. And W.C. Fields, and you know, just it goes on forever. I'm a hotbed of influences.
Did you draw little monsters in the margins of your notebook?
I did. Oh, yes, I did indeed. And I had a strange experience in that I went through some stuff that from the family. My parents are dead, and there was a bunch of stuff there. And I there's one box which had these drawings I'd done as a little teeny bitsy kid. And they were pre-literate. You know, I was really a little itsy bitsy. And they're monsters. You know, they're all kinds of stuff like that. And there's one, I remember one has in a mother's loving hand, it says, a strange monster come to kill us all. And so I was doing that kind of junk way back then.
When you came to New York with your portfolio of cartoons and tried to sell them to magazines, was it hard to get in initially?
Very, yeah, because I'm still regarded as sort of far out in some circles. And at that point, I was really, really far out. And, I mean, I was really bizarre. What happened to me was this singularly frustrating scene where the editors would say, look at this stuff. And they'd laugh at it hysterically and just think it was marvelous and compliment me on, this is marvelous, kid, you're really great, this is great stuff, kid. But our readers would never understand it, and then they would hand it back to me. And that was my big block, was that they figured that I was beyond the those jerks out there.
Could you maybe describe a couple of those early cartoons?
Oh, sure. Let's see. There's this fellow, and he's in a cannibal pot. He's being cooked. And he has an evil look on his face, and he has a bottle of poison, and he's pouring the poison in the water he's being cooked in, and that was one. And then let me see. There was one where there's this little kid, and he's with his father, and they're in a snowstorm, and there's this dead bird on a snowbank with his feet in the air, and the little kid's pointing at it, and he says, look, Daddy, the first robin. That kind of stuff. It was very much in keeping with what I do today.
You grew up in Evanston, Illinois.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's an obvious difference between a Midwestern sensibility and a New York sensibility?
Oh, God, yes. The Midwest is a very sort of gothic place, but it pretends it isn't. The southern states relish their strangeness and have great fun. They have great pride in playing with the spookiness of their life. And the Midwest pretends that everything is fine. I mean, this is a sort of the general reaction. You say, "What sort of day is this? Fine? How are you? I'm fine." You just pretend that everything is, but it's really weird out there. I mean, it is. And some of the weirdest murderers we've got in our history come from the Midwest, operated there.
I've picked out a couple of cartoons that I think are maybe examples of how you'd do a cartoon about the Midwest and about New York. Could you do them for us?
Well, the one that you picked was this. There's two farmers in a. You can say that it's raining, and there's been this incredible flood, and you see that they're in the water up to their shoulders, and everything around them is covered hopelessly with water. I mean, everything has been destroyed. And they're ruined, both of them. And the one farmer says to the other, it's times like these you find out if you're basically optimistic or not. And that's a country kind of joke, I think. And it's true. It's a true statement. Very, very often the humor in the cartoon is simply that it's true. Then the other one here is a big city one. And this was, yes, I did a little section on New York, but it could be taken as any major city, and a person who's not used to major cities being exposed to it. And this is, I have a part of it is the perils of mass transit. For example, I have a guy coming out of the subway who is having graffiti sprayed on his raincoat.
And his head.
And his head, and so on, right. Always happens, and the
So I say you've got to avoid the whenever possible, the subways and the buses. But anything is better than the city's deadly taxis. And here's this guy, and he's sitting in the back of this taxi, and there's this sign here among the other ones, like about don't smoke and all the rest of it, and don't complain about the filth and the rest of it. And one sign says no smoking, and it ignites the poison gas. And sure enough, there's some poison gas coming out of the little divider, which protects the passenger from the driver. And the passenger's looking at it with some suspicion. And from the back of the seat is emerging a man with a gas mask and clawed fingers. And he will soon destroy the fellow. And this is the kind of thing that does cross your mind when you're in one of these vile New York taxis. I mean, they're obviously death traps. And you think of these, you know, the inns of legend where if you stayed the night, the landlord would come and kill you and probably cook you. I'm sure that some taxis are doing that right now today.
You have a very rounded signature. Your letters are really pretty round. Did you work at what your signature would be when you were signing your cartoons? And do you use the same signature to endorse your checks?
The signature on the checks is considerably sloppier, so don't try anything cute. The other thing is I was always irritated at cartoonists who shyly scrawled their signatures. You couldn't make it out. I thought, why have they gone to all this trouble? And then they write on the bottom. I didn't like that. And I also didn't like these old-timey signatures that have little hearts over the I dots and all that sort of stuff. So I thought, let's just write the damn name, okay? And that's what I do. I try to write clearly and neatly, so that anybody can read it if they are so inclined. That's really what I do with it. It's a nice signature. And I fool around with it. Sometimes what I like to do very often is I like to, I'm looking at this one here. I see there's a horizon line, and I've got the Gayan on top of the horizon. I've got the Wilson under the horizon line. That's cute. And then I have one with a little table leg, and I've got the little sort of tail at the end of the ends at the Gayan and the Wilson, both sort of coyly going behind the leg of the table. I like to fool around with it that way.
Okay. I want to thank you, Gayan Wilson, so much for being with us.
Well,
I really enjoy
you.
Your cartoons, and I really thank you for being here today.
Thank you. I had a swell time.
That was cartoonist and social satirist Gayan Wilson. His latest book, Gayan Wilson's America, is published by Simon & Schuster. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Ron Barron and Jay Goldman. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Sallet is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview or for a listing of other Fresh Air programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4892. The number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.